Welcome back to Question Madison 2019. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Here we go. As promised, I give a lecture every year titled The Top Articles of 2018 or 2017 or 2016. Pretty much whatever the previous year was, come January, I give a lecture. I give this lecture over and over at different conferences and different grand rounds and different CMEs. And this is going to be that lecture. I am giving this lecture to you for free. Now, although many other individuals have paid for this lecture, they've paid to go to conferences where I have given this lecture, this really is this lecture in the entirety, and you're getting it for free 50 free. Yeah, that's right, free. Unfortunately, though, you're not getting the CME credits that go with it. That's just the name of the game. Sorry, I don't have that much money to put into this podcast to get CME credits, but without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Like I said, Question Medicine 2019, and this is the top articles of 2018. This is basically my lecture. I actually was going to record this lecture live and then post it, but then I realized that sometimes some of these lectures don't translate well from in the lecture hall to on the podcast, because sometimes you say, and in this article, but that's what you say in the lecture hall because behind you is a big screen that shows the article and you don't actually say the whole article out loud. So instead, I'm recording it separately. This is what I think the top articles of 2018 are. And because this is meant to be an hour-long lecture, this will likely get broken down into two or three pieces. But without further ado, here we go. The objectives of this whole lecture are for you to learn something. There's a thing called adult education. It's like a library card. I can either force you to do it or force you to use it. I can neither force you to learn something you don't want to learn, nor teach you something that you don't want to be taught. So by the end of this whole series, I hope that you've learned something that will change your practice. I must admit, though, I have conflicts of interest. See, my conflict of interest is that VA, or the Veteran Affairs Hospital, pays part of my salary. Hippo Education for last year paid part of my salary. And All Care Family Medical, which is a side gig thing that I do, paid part of my salary. When you look at what I'm going to pay taxes on next year, those are the individuals who are paying my salary. Those are the individuals that are putting bread on my table, if you will. I'm putting a roof over my head. But you see, none of my employers have ever given me money for a particular opinion that was not my own. If you go to openpaymentsdata.cms.gov, that's actually one of my favorite things to do anytime anyone's giving a lecture, you can type in somebody's name and you can see how much money did Big Pharma give them during the previous year, or what is their true conflicts of interest. My favorite thing is when a lecturer gets up and says, I have no conflicts of interest to declare, and then you go to openpayments.cms and what do you know? It's like $9 million that somebody's been paid. And you think to yourself, how can you have no conflicts of interest? Somebody's paying you a insane amount of money. So if you go to Open Payments last year, or at least in 2017, because the 2018 data is not out yet, in 2017, I got paid $82.85 from Big Pharma. I will open and honestly tell you, I have zero idea where this money came from. I cannot pinpoint it. I cannot tell you where it's come from. I've tried to dispute this. I've created an account. I've sent an email and asked, where did this money come from? I don't go to drug up dinners anymore. I literally have no idea where this money came from. But that's what it says on there. And so that's what we got to go with. Now, the purpose of this whole presentation, the whole purpose of this presentation is that I want to make you aware of what I think are the top articles that come out each year, because we know that it takes way too much to keep up with the actual literature. This whole concept has been talked about multiple times in the literature. The study's been done over and over again, but my favorite one comes from the Journal of Med Library Association 2004, in which they took five primary care physicians. In those physicians independently evaluated articles based on that evaluation of the articles, they then estimated how long or how much time it would take for an individual trained in epidemiology to read the over 7,000 articles that are published monthly. And what do you know, that number comes out to 627.5 hours per month. Yes, that is right. 27 hours per month. That is equivalent to 26.125 days, to be exact. That's 26 days per month without pass and go, without collecting $500, without going to the bathroom, without talking to your family, without eating, without drinking, without sleeping, just reading for 26 straight days. We know that that's impossible. There's no one out there that can do this for 26 straight days. So the purpose of this one, the purpose of the game changers of 2018, the top articles of 2018, is for me to tell you what I think the top articles are and make you aware of them. Now, I have to tell you that this is completely my own independent analysis. It's my own independent decision. There are no meta-analysis for what the top articles are. There are no randomized controlled trials, no systematic reviews. Oh yes, it is just I, your humble host, that is telling you what I think the best articles are. And that type of independent individual analysis can only be shown, or more clearly shown, in a paper from this year, 2018, titled Many Analysis, One Data Set, Making Transparent How Variations and Analytic Choices Affect Results. What they did here was that they gave 29 teams of analysts an objective and a data set. They gave them the data set and said, listen, you need to tell us whether soccer referees are more likely to give red cards to dark skin toned players than to light skin toned players. And they gave them the whole data set of all the red cards given during a particular soccer year. And they said, go ahead and look it up. And these were really smart individuals. I mean, we're talking about associated professors, full professors, postdoctoral students, doctoral students. These were really smart individuals, and 29 teams in all. And wouldn't you know, when it came down to it, 69% of the teams said, oh yeah, absolutely, dark-skinned players get more red cards than light-skinned players. 69%. But that means 31% said, no, actually, there is no statistical difference here. They all get them about the same. Of the 29 teams, no team had the exact same analysis. None. Depending on how you looked at the data, you could spin it, switch it, flip it, and flop it whatever way you wanted to. And you weren't necessarily wrong in that. In fact, you weren't wrong at all. It just depends on how you look at the data. This lecture is very much the same. If I asked every single individual, what are the top articles of last year? I'm sure everyone has their own independent analysis. You're not wrong. It doesn't mean that you skewed the data, or twisted the data, or made the data your own. It just means the way that you looked at it, that's the way that it worked. So, with that being said, I have to tell you, again, this is the nuts, butts, and guts of what we have to get through. I have 1 hour to tell you all the articles of 2018, and that's impossible. One of the guidelines I'm actually going to tell you about from 2018 is 350 pages long. That guideline alone is an hour-long lecture, if not a two-hour-long lecture. But I am just trying to bring your self-conscious, or your subconscious, I should say, make you aware of what's out there, what's being done, what's being talked about, and what came up in 2018, in case you were not reading for 26 days straight, every month for the entire year. So here we go. I think the first thing we discuss is the death of aspirin. Oh yes, in 2018, aspirin died. And why do we think this is important? Well, it's because currently the United States Preventive Services Task Force, they recommend low-dose aspirin in those 50 to 59 years with a 10% 10-year cardiovascular disease risk. If you have an ASCVD risk score greater than 10%, well then, boom, put them on aspirin. But if you're between the ages of 60 and 69 with a greater than 10% score, they say, well, that should probably be an individual patient decision. However, they're recommending it. Now, let's go to the evidence and why I think in 2018, aspirin died. First of all, we had the ASCEND trial. That's right, the ASCEND trial. This multi-center, double-blind, randomized controlled trial took roughly 15,000 middle-aged or diabetic, had to be diabetic to get in, patients, and randomized them to daily aspirin, 100 milligrams, or placebo. They had them follow up after about 7 years, And they were looking for the primary outcome of the first vascular event, but then they were also looking at the safety outcomes of the first major bleed. When they looked at the primary outcome of first vascular event, they found kind of what we'd all expect to see. Aspirin was better than placebo at 7-8 years out. It beat it. It was great. You didn't have a vascular event. But when you compare that to the first major bleed, whether this be an intracranial bleed, a bleed in the eye, serious GI bleeding, or any other major GI bleeding or any other bleeding, the harms washed out the benefits, and there was no benefit. No benefit in those that had diabetes. So let's move on to the ARRIVE trial. The ARRIVE trial arrives us where we need to talk about next, which was non-diabetic patients. These patients on entry had on average an ASCVD risk score of 18%. 18%. For any of us that do primary care, you know an 18% per patient is a what we would consider quote-unquote high-risk individual. An individual that we would say, oh, this patient needs not only an aspirin, they probably need a statin. They will benefit. Here we go, primary prevention. This is it. This is the main course, if you will. Well, in this randomized double-blind placebo control multi-center study, they did just that. They took 100 milligrams of aspirin or placebo, and they looked at the primary endpoint, which was cardiovascular-related death, myocardial infarction, unstable angina, stroke, and TIA. And what do you know? When they followed them out just over right about 6 years or so, not only were the lines between placebo and aspirin so close they looked like they were touching, they basically were touching. There was no difference. It didn't matter. And again, these are individuals with an ASCVD risk score of 18%. It surely should have worked in these individuals, but it didn't. And that brings us to our last trial in the New England Journal of Medicine, the effects of aspirin on all-cause mortality in healthy elderly individuals. Again, this is healthy elderly people. I mean, come on. If it's going to work, then it's going to work in those greater than the age of 70, which is what it took to get into this trial. 20,000 individuals, 20,000 old individuals taking either 100 milligrams of enteric-coated aspirin or placebo with a follow-up of close to 5 years. In this multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, what did we find? Well, when they looked at disability-free survival, they found shocking results. And it may not be shocking in the fact that no other trial has actually shown benefit so far, because there was no benefit with aspirin or placebo, so why would we expect to see it now? But when they looked at all-cause death, yes, when they looked at all-cause death, aspirin actually had a higher risk of all-cause death. And not only did it have a higher risk of all-cause death, when you broke that down just a little bit further, death related to cancer was higher in the aspirin group. I mean, oh my goodness. What is the reason for this? I don't quite know. I'm not a smart enough man to figure it out. Maybe it's that it's what we're doing now seems to be better than what we were doing before. In previous studies in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we didn't have statins, metformin, and these empagliflozin, and these other medications that we now currently have that may be just as good as aspirin and really don't yield the same benefit in giving aspirin. Or maybe aspirin just doesn't work like we thought that it once does. Or maybe it's just the 20,000 patients are giving us a lie and this is just a statistical anomaly. I don't think it's the last one. I do think it's probably one of the first ones. Or maybe it's dose dependent, right? Maybe 81 milligrams isn't the target. And maybe because our society is becoming more obese, we need a higher dose aspirin. That's also a possibility. There are a lot of things that could be here, but I think 81 milligrams for primary prevention is now out the door. Shouldn't be done. I'm not doing it. In fact, I'm de-prescribing it, if anything, because in 2018, aspirin died. And with that being said, on to the next article, shall we? The next article of 2018 is partial oral versus intravenous antibiotic treatment of endocarditis. This is in New England Journal of Medicine, 2018. This is a randomized multicenter trial, and this was called the POET trial. Yes, the POET trial. And this objective of this study was to determine if a shift in intravenous to oral antibiotics would result in efficacy and safety similar to continued intravenous treatment. Their outcome was composite of all-cause mortality, embolic events, unplanned cardiac surgery, and a relapse of bacteremia for randomization through 6 months after completion of antibiotic therapy. I think the important thing here is we all know that endocarditis is a bad thing. If one of your heart valves has an infection on it, that is not a good thing. We all understand that this has a very high in-hospital mortality, somewhere around 15%. But we also know that most of that morbidity and mortality comes in the first 10 to 15 days. So this is a big deal because currently, no matter where you are, Journal of Circulation or the American Heart Association and then the European Society of Cardiology both say that endocarditis takes 6 weeks of IV therapy, 6 weeks of IV antibiotics. So this set out and said, well, once we've got you stabilized, once you've been in the hospital, you're stabilized on IV antibiotics, we have your cultures back, we know what you're growing, could we just discharge you on oral medications? They discharge patients after a median of 17 days. Now, there's some slight details to this that need to be worked and discussed, and such as they were having patients follow up with a primary care doctor once a week afterwards. They put them on two oral antibiotics. They were continuously checking on these patients, but here's what you need to know. When you looked at all the outcomes that we talked about, there was no difference. There was no statistical difference. The primary outcome occurred in 9% of the orally treated group and 12.1% of the patients on full course intravenous therapy. That's a 3% difference. That was not statistically different. But again, I think this is huge because once insurance companies get a hold of this and they say, whoa, wait a second, you mean we don't have to pay for someone to be in the hospital for 6 weeks? We can pay for someone to be in the hospital, let's say for, I don't know, 2 weeks, and then we can pay for them to go home with oral antibiotics. That seems way better. I do think that seems way better. I must say that only 5 patients in this POET trial or the POET study were intravenous drug users. So if you have endocarditis and they're not drug users, they are drug users, this may not apply to your patient population. But again, this is important because we can maybe send these patients home instead of keeping them in a hospital or a skilled nursing facility or some other facility. And speaking of keeping people in a facility, I have to tell you there are 2 things in this world that I would absolutely hate. One of them is a stroke. If I have a stroke, grab the double barrel and pull the trigger. But something else in medicine that I think I would hate would be to be renting a chair 3 days a week. If I had to rent a chair on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I might go crazy. And of course, I'm talking about dialysis. If I had to be on dialysis 3 days a week to get my blood filtered out of all the toxins that are becoming in my system because my kidneys couldn't do it any longer, I'm not sure what I would do, to be honest with you. Well, this paper from 2018, September 4th, Annals of Internal Medicine, titled 12-month outcomes after transplant of hepatitis C infected kidneys into uninfected recipients, a single group trial. Now, this is an open label, non-randomized trial. This was actually a combination of 2 trials that happened earlier, and then this is the 12-month follow-up. Here's what's going on here. They have patients that were renting a chair 3 days a week, and they went to those patients and said, hey, you need a kidney. The person in the chair said, yeah, of course I need a kidney. They said, well, we have good news for you. We have a kidney ready to transplant for you. The individual in the chair said, well, wonderful. What's the bad news? And they said, well, the bad news is the kidney that we have ready to transplant for you is Hep C positive. Oh, yes, Hep C positive. Well, in these 2 trials, the Thinker trial and the Expander trial, when they followed them up after 12 months, 10 patients in each trial, all 20 patients had undetectable levels of the Hep C virus RNA. This was essentially a cure. And that's what this showed. We know that the failure rate of these drugs are around 3%. But we know that people that are on hemodialysis or getting dialysis have a mortality of somewhere around 7%. Per the best numbers I can find, in 2016, we threw away 500 kidneys, and we have hundreds of more kidneys that we didn't even harvest because we said they have Hep C. They're of no use to us. But when we follow these patients up, we give them a Hep C kidney. We put them on Hep C treatment. We then cure the Hep C in the kidney. These individuals are not only Hep C, they now have a working kidney and they no longer need to rent a chair 3 days a week, and they have a totally normal working kidney. This will change how we can handle medicine. This changes a lot of things in medicine. This changes our end-stage renal disease population, dialysis population. I mean, the dialysis population is a huge, huge financial burden on the medical community, and this is game-changing. I know that we are coming up on 20 minutes, so I'm going to bring in one more trial, and then the rest of these articles will have to be brought up again in the coming weeks or the coming months. And like I said, I have so many plans, so just hold tight, stay with us. Questioning Medicine 2019, huge. I'm releasing so many podcasts. Here we go. Next trial is New England Journal of Medicine, a randomized trial of epinephrine in out of hospital cardiac arrest. This is a multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. The objective of the study was to determine if epinephrine was beneficial in the treatment of out of hospital cardiac arrest. The primary outcome was the rate of survival at 30 days, and then they looked at the secondary outcome, which was survival to hospital discharge with a favorable neurological outcome. So basically, here's what you're doing. If you're in the intervention arm, you got IV epinephrine, 1 milligram, Q3 to Q5 minutes, plus standard care. If you're in the comparator arm, you just got normal saline. This is important because per ACLS protocol, epinephrine is given since like the 1960s. It's just one of those things we do over and over and over again. And they use what I would consider an awesome correlation or awesome outcome, which they looked at your neurological outcome. I mean, it's kind of like cancer screening. Who cares if we can screen for cancer if we can't actually do anything about it to prevent then or cure the cancer? Who cares if we can bring you back or get ROSC if what we do doesn't lead you to a favorable outcome? So they used the modified Rankin scale, and what they tried to determine was if you were beneficial or if you had a functional score of 3 or greater. Now, on this Rankin scale, 0 is no symptoms, 6 is death, 3 means you have moderate disability. You require some help, but you're able to walk without any assistance. If you have a wife or you can have someone come into your house, you can probably get by on your own. Now, a 4, so from 3 to 4, that is 4 is severe disability, unable to walk without assistance and unable to attend your own bodily needs without assistance. This puts you in a nursing home. This puts you in a skilled nursing facility for the rest of your life. That difference between 3 and 4 in the modified Rankin scale is huge. Well, what do you think they found? 30-day survival. If you were given epinephrine, absolutely. You had a higher likelihood that you would survive to 30-day survival. But when you looked at the survival to hospital discharge with a favorable neurological outcome, there was no difference. So we were getting these people to 30-day survival, but as far as neurologically outcome, they were vegetables, or at least not vegetables, but at least had to go to nursing homes or had to go to facilities, possibly for the rest of their life. I think that this is saying a lot. I think that this says, hey, listen, maybe we shouldn't be doing this whole epinephrine thing in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Maybe there should be different algorithms. Now, granted, on average, we're talking 21 minutes from the time that the first epinephrine dose was given, so you can't correlate this to in-hospital cardiac arrest, but this is certainly something that we should talk about with our patients as far as out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and this is this what you really want? Do you really want to live if you're not really living? Do you really want to live if you're living at a nursing home? I will leave you that little nugget to ponder. We have many more articles to go through. I think we're about halfway there, but I will end this episode as I've ended every episode before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.